This is tape number 2 on Plato. For Plato, the connections among philosophical questions are more basic and more important than their differences. These connections are especially noticeable in the relation between Plato's view of ethics and his political theory. Here we find a connection between the life of the individual, which ethics is concerned with, and the life of society, or the state, which is the subject of political theory. For Plato, in fact, the state is a more fundamental entity than the individual, not because the state is larger or more powerful, but because human existence is itself essentially social. A person who is not part of a social or political structure would have a hard time surviving at all. Even if the lone individual did survive physically, he'd not yet be human. Plato believes that to be human, one must be part of a society. From this relation, people draw their ways of thinking and their values, beginning with the very language they depend on. In this sense, Plato holds that the individual is subservient to society or the state, not the other way around. This conception of the relation between the individual and the state is the basis for the best known of all Plato's dialogues, the Republic. The Republic is organized around the question, what is justice? Typically, Plato edges up to this question obliquely from the question of whether it is more rewarding and pleasurable to be just than to be unjust. Like many Athenians at the time, and like many people at all times, several of the characters in the beginning of Plato's Republic believe that acting justly does not pay. In any event, they believe acting justly is not the way of the world. So, for example, Thrasymachus challenges Socrates.
You think that shepherds are considering the good of their sheep and cattle. And by the same token, you seem to suppose that the rulers in our cities think of something more than the sources of their own profit. But the truth is just the other way round. You should look at the matter in this way, my simple-minded Socrates, that the just man always comes out at a disadvantage in his relation with the unjust.
Plato takes this challenge seriously, but in order to prove that acting justly is not only right, but also more practical, Plato pushes the issue back a step to the question of what justice is. That's the question he wants to consider anyway. We have to answer this question, he asserts, before we can determine the consequences of either justice or injustice. And one way to find the answer is to inquire about justice not in the life of the individual, but, as he says, writ large, at the level of the state.
Since there is a justice of one man, and also a justice of an entire city, then perhaps there would be more justice in the larger object, and it would be easier to apprehend there. Accordingly, let us look for this quality in states, and only then examine it also in the individual, looking for the likeness of the greater in the form of the less.
By this indirect route, Plato formulates the issues to be addressed in the dialogue. What is the nature of the just or ideal state? What role do individual citizens have in that state? Who should govern? What are their qualifications? How will this ideal state come into existence? These are obviously very broad questions. Plato's response to them touches on a variety of topics. So Plato's account of the state includes a theory of education, how children are to be raised in the ideal society, and an analysis of literature and art, which should be part of that education. Plato includes as well a theory of human nature and psychology, why people act as they do. And finally, he presents his theory of knowledge and a view of his metaphysics. If we're to know what the ideal state is, we have to understand also what knowledge itself is. For Plato, then, all these topics are not merely relevant, they are necessary. This assertion is one of the most striking claims of the Republic. Plato, like many later writers, assumes that governments were first formed in response to certain physical needs. In order to provide food and shelter, societies arrive at a division of labor. Then they create a system of laws and the means for enforcing those laws in order to support the organization of the state. But a society or state that goes no further than this, Plato suggests, would not satisfy all the needs of its citizens. They wouldn't realize any potential beyond their physical, biological requirements.
It is not merely the origin of a city that we need to consider, but a city that will no longer be confined to necessities. We must then proceed to fill out its bulk with a multitude of things that exceed the requirements of necessity. For example, with the poets and musicians, with the soldiers and with those who are to govern.
In a society concerned only with material needs, there would be no life of the mind. There would be no goal for living other than to survive physically. Certainly, there would be no place for the ideals of ethics or political justice. But this can be changed. The state, Plato believes, ought to secure not only the physical life of its citizens, but also their social and human needs, the needs of the spirit or mind. It's difficult, of course, to know exactly what these needs are, but it's essential to speculate about them if we're to imagine what an ideal state might be. Since Plato wrote The Republic, many other writers have also produced versions of an ideal or utopian society. The term utopia itself comes from Thomas More's 17th century description of his ideal society. More used the Greek term utopia, which means nowhere, to describe an ideal state that does not yet or may never exist. The state that Plato describes in The Republic remains the best known, if not the most admired, of the many utopias that philosophers have conjured up. It's been attacked almost as often as it's been praised. So, for example, one recent critic, Terence Irwin, concludes,
Plato's attitude to democracy began a tradition of philosophical hostility or indifference. He wants to replace the dominance of force, manipulation, propaganda, and ignorance with the results of rational and objective inquiry. But to agree with him about this is not to admire his ideal state.
The most extreme charge against the Republic, that in the end it amounts to no more than a fascist or totalitarian state, would, if valid, be serious indeed. It's important, then, to follow the development of the dialogue as Plato presents it. Only then can we understand why a thinker of Plato's stature would conceive of his Republic as an ideal form of government. Plato's conception of the ideal state is based on a distinction that's not political at all. He emphasizes in The Republic, as elsewhere, that knowledge is fundamentally different from opinions or beliefs that often pass as knowledge.
Beliefs are not in the habit of staying put for long, but run away from a person's soul. So they are not worth much until one ties them down by reasoning. And this is why knowledge is more valuable even than true belief.
Plato draws this distinction from everyday experience, from common sense. We usually just take for granted that if we need a certain kind of work done, we'll turn to someone who we believe has the training and knowledge to do the job. We insist on trained professionals in medicine and science. This would also be true in sailing a ship, training horses, two of Plato's favorite examples. Some people are more expert in doing these things than others. They have the know-how to do them better than others who lack knowledge or experience. It seems obvious to Plato that this same rule should hold true for governing a state. In other words, the rulers of a state ought to have the necessary training and knowledge to do their job. Not everybody has this knowledge. More importantly, Plato concludes, not everybody has the capacity or talent even to acquire this knowledge. Differences in natural ability, according to Plato, must be taken into account in organizing a state, if indeed the state is to function well and justly. Accordingly, Plato divides the inhabitants of his ideal republic into three groups or classes. These classes correspond approximately to people's different abilities. He believes the classes are also necessary for the state to provide for the different kinds of work it requires. First, there will be a class of artisans or producers, the workers. A second class is made up of auxiliaries or administrators, who will also serve as soldiers. The third class is made up of the governors or guardians, who have the knowledge and training required to make just laws and political decisions. Assigning people to these groups will be based not on birth or social status, but on ability. Initially, all children in the state begin their education together. At a certain point in their education, the children are judged in terms of their potential. Then they're assigned to a particular class, the one in which they will remain for the rest of their lives. Plato is vague about how this all-important decision will be made, but he assumes that there will be an accurate and fair way to do it. Since the Republic itself is an ideal, he imagines also that there will be an ideal solution to its practical problems. Plato's main interest, of course, is with the class of the guardians or rulers. It is they, after all, who will decide on the laws and policies of the state. To be certain that the guardians are qualified for this role, they must undergo a rigorous education. This begins in infancy and goes on continuously until, only after many years, the guardians take up their responsibilities as rulers.
Only by seeing how we are to bring up and to educate these people will we advance toward discerning what is the object of our entire inquiry. the origin of justice and injustice in a state.
Plato describes this process of education in some detail. Instruction begins first by training the senses and the body. Music and gymnastics convey the first lessons. But this music, and the arts more generally, must be only a particular kind. Plato believed that all art is representational, that it stands for or expresses certain attitudes or values. Since children imitate what they see or hear, it's important that their music and their stories should represent positive values, like courage, temperance, and piety. Children exposed to these values will imitate them in their own lives. This means, then, that children should not be allowed to see or hear many other things, since if they did, they would imitate those also. Especially literature, Plato believes, has to be severely censored because writers so often depict weak characters and harmful emotions.
Both poets and writers of prose speak wrongly about men in matters of greatest moment, saying that there are many examples of men who are unjust but happy, and that just men are wretched, and that there is profit in injustice if it be concealed. I presume that we shall forbid them to say this sort of thing, and command them to sing and fable the opposite.
Plato is suspicious of poetry and fiction in general, not only in the education of the young. His censorship of the arts in the Republic thus extends to all ages. He sees the arts, which express and evoke emotion, as a threat to reason. Many later philosophers in the rationalist tradition, like Spinoza and Descartes, would follow Plato in this belief. So the guardians begin their education with gymnastics and the heavily censored arts. The progression after this is long, moving steadily in the direction of increasing abstractness and difficulty, to mathematics, geometry, and astronomy. At the age of 30, the guardians-to-be begin a 5-year-long study of dialectic, or philosophy. Next, the potential guardians serve a 15-year apprenticeship during which they hold various administrative offices. And finally, at the age of 50, they achieve the status of guardians. These people are then supposed to know what justice is for the state because they've achieved justice within themselves.
Justice means that a person must not allow the impulses in his soul to interfere and meddle with one another, but that having attained self-mastery within himself, he should then, and only then, turn to practice in political action.
Plato holds that not only the guardians, but also all the other people in the state, in order to achieve justice, must be assigned to the classes for which they are suited. There are two principal reasons for this. First, everyone in an ideal state ought to be doing the work for which he's best suited. Whatever their work, people in jobs for which they're not qualified or which they don't want will do these jobs badly. In Plato's view, this combination of discontent and incompetence would disrupt the ideal balance of a just state. He embraces this first and crucial principle, however, without considering the serious question of how to decide who is best suited for what work. Plato believes that the assignment to classes is also necessary for a second reason, that in their positions, the guardians or rulers will have genuine knowledge, understanding exactly what the needs and possibilities of a just society are. This is, after all, what their role in the ideal state requires. They become rulers only once this requirement has been met. In a number of the proposals mentioned so far, Plato assumes without argument that people differ naturally in their abilities. He also assumes that these abilities are relevant to governing a state. He's aware of many of the objections that might be raised against these views, and he responds to them at least in part. So, for example, there's the question of deciding exactly how the members of the guardian class are to be chosen. Who decides? On what basis? Here, Plato's answer mainly repeats and insists on the goal to be achieved. The guardians must be chosen on the basis of their ability to do their work, that is, to govern justly. Initially, everyone's eligible. And here, in fact, Plato takes a step that was quite radical for his time. He includes women as well as men among those who are eligible to rule. The only condition, again, is that a potential guardian should be qualified.
Then there is no pursuit of the administrators of a state that belongs to a woman because she is a woman, or to a man because he is a man. But the natural capacities are distributed alike among both creatures, and women naturally share in all pursuits. For the production of a female guardian, then, Our education will not be one thing for men and another for women, especially since the nature which we hand over to it is the same.
There are, of course, other problems to be faced. Plato tries to make certain, for example, that people will not be attracted to the role of guardians in order to gain power or because of its potential material rewards. To ensure this, the guardians are forbidden to own property. If they had private belongings, that would be an incentive for them to follow their own interests, not those of the community. They're not even allowed to enjoy the usual pleasure of family life. Childbearing is to be arranged by the state, even to the details of matchmaking. Plato was an early believer in eugenics, the doctrine that children should be bred in order to produce the greatest amount of talent and intelligence. The children who are born to guardians, moreover, are supposed to accept all guardians equally as their parents. Yet even here, Plato tries to avoid the possibility of favoritism. We might expect that the members of all the classes, the guardians, the artisans, and the auxiliaries, might object that there's little incentive for them to accept their assigned roles in this highly regulated state. So one of the characters in the Republic, Adimantus, has this to say.
What will be your defense, Socrates, if anyone objects that you are not making these men very happy, and that through their own fault? For the city really belongs to them, and yet they get no enjoyment out of it, as ordinary men do, by owning lands and building fine big houses and providing them with suitable furniture, and winning the favor of the gods by private sacrifices, and entertaining guests, and enjoying all those possessions of gold and silver that is customary for those who are expecting to be happy.
Plato answers this objection by stressing that the guardians, because they are rational, will recognize the importance of their role in the state. As a result of their education and the way they're required to live, they should not put undue value on material goods. But to ensure this, and also to ensure that the other citizens accept their roles, Plato refers here, once again, to a myth. His phrase, a noble lie, which is to be told to all the citizens of the Republic. While being created, this story goes, some people have been mixed with gold, some with silver, some with the baser metals of tin and lead. Nature, then, is responsible for the different positions they have in the state, for the different lives they're to lead there. With this story as a disguise for the truth, Plato believes, the citizens of the state will accept the roles given them. Here, just as with the other myths that Plato relates in the dialogues, the kernel of the myth is something that Plato believes is literally true, that there are natural differences in ability among people. Those differences, he holds, are quite fundamental in determining what people should do with their lives. But what happens to justice in this arrangement? The Republic as a whole is to be constructed around the ideal of justice. And Plato now points out that justice is not something in addition to all these other arrangements. He writes,
"Now is the time for us, like huntsmen, to surround the animal's hiding place and to keep watch, so that justice may not slip through and get away from us and vanish from our sight."
According to Plato, when all the classes in a society are doing what they're qualified to do and doing it well, then the state functions harmoniously, or justly. Similarly, everyone has different impulses in his soul, and when they are in equilibrium, the individual is just. In this way, there's a direct connection between justice in the state and justice in the individual, a claim that Plato had assumed at the very beginning of the Republic. From our world of 20th century democracy, Plato's version of utopia involves certain obvious difficulties. The Republic constantly subordinates the good of the individual to the good of the state, allowing little, if any, room for self-determination. To be sure, in Plato's view, this is done for the good of the individual as well as for the good of the state, but this is a considerable restriction on the individual. It's fair to say, in fact, that Plato does not introduce a conception of individual rights at all. This by itself might make Plato's Republic seem much less than an ideal state. There is, however, one crucial feature in Plato's account that distinguishes his republic from the varieties of totalitarianism experienced in the 20th century, tyrannies to which the republic is sometimes compared. Plato repeatedly insists that those who govern must truly be qualified by ability and by education. They govern not because they have seized power, but because they have the wisdom required for solving the problems that any state encounters. This is the ideal. And if they don't have such wisdom, they would not be in power. This, at least, is Plato's stipulation. and he insistently reminds us that the alternative is that government should be in the hands of people who gain power either by guile, deceiving the people whom they rule, or by physical force. He compares the true guardian to the captain of a ship. What would happen, he asks, if the crew did not believe that their leader should be the captain?
Conceive the sailors to be wrangling with one another for control of the helm, each claiming that it is his right to steer, though he has never learned the art and cannot point out his teacher or any time when he studied it. And, what is more, they affirm that it cannot be taught at all. But they are ready to make mincemeat of anyone who says that it can be taught. And, meanwhile, they are always clustered about the captain, importuning him, and sticking at nothing to turn the helm over to them. And sometimes, if they fail, and others get his ear, they put the others to death, or cast them out from the ship. And then, after binding or drugging the worthy captain, they take command of the ship and consume its stores. And, if that were not enough, they praise and celebrate as a navigator, a pilot, a master of shipcraft, the man who is most cunning to lend a hand in persuading the captain to let them rule. While the man who lacks this craft, they condemn as useless.
Some critics believe that Plato's description of the faults of democracy would be convincing only if he proposed a practical alternative. He might be convincing, for example, if we could be certain that the people who gain power are indeed those who are best qualified. But have most political leaders achieved the status of guardians? Can such an ideal, or the ideal of the Republic as a whole, really be realized? Plato recognizes the practical difficulties that stand in the way of this, but in his view, even these do not diminish the importance of his ideal.
What we sought was a model to show us what justice was. We were not trying to show that the thing is possible. Take a painter now. If he should paint a pattern of the ideally beautiful man, but he could not prove that such a man is possible, do you think he would be the worse painter for that?
In other words, ideals are important, whether or not they can be fully realized. The crucial question is whether they are indeed ideals. Even if we accepted everything Plato has so far claimed about the Republic, we would still not know exactly what equips the guardians for their role. What is the knowledge or wisdom they require? To answer this question, Plato feels obliged to introduce us to his general theory of knowledge, a theory which applies not only to politics, but wherever knowledge is required for making judgments or decisions. Plato's theory is based first on the distinction between genuine knowledge and sense experience, between knowledge and the opinions or beliefs that often pass themselves off as knowledge. In one of the most famous passages of the Republic, Plato describes the contrast between knowledge and other forms of experience through the image of a divided line, a vertical line that he then cuts into four sections. The major distinction in the divided line is between knowledge and opinion.
There are these two entities. One of them is sovereign over the intelligible order, and the other over the world of the physical eye. There are then these two types, the visible and the intelligible.
Opinion, he suggests, is produced by the senses and the imagination, both of which leave the way open to errors and false beliefs. The least accurate form of opinion is based on phantasms and the images of dreams. Very little can be known from this source. Sense experience is a step above dreaming or phantasms, but sense experience also fails to yield genuine knowledge. Our senses frequently make mistakes. Even when we check up on them, we still may be mistaken because we usually check them with the senses themselves. The upper part of Plato's divided line represents knowledge in contrast to opinion. Unlike opinion, knowledge achieves certainty, although here too there are different kinds. One kind of certainty Plato assigns to mathematics. Mathematics produces certainty, however, only on the basis of assumptions or axioms that are themselves unproven. A second kind of knowledge, the highest level of knowledge, is reached through reason. Reason grasps those principles of experience which don't require any assumptions, apart from what the principles themselves provide. Plato gives these principles the special name of forms, and from these forms, he claims, both reality and knowledge are constituted. The ideal of justice that Plato hopes to define in the Republic is an example of a form. This ideal is objective, unchanging, independent of any particular historical setting. Much has been written about Plato's theory of forms. Indeed, it's the most famous of all his doctrines, the one most commonly associated with his name. But the questions that he himself hoped to answer by the theory of forms still remain in the aftermath of that theory. What exactly are the forms? What evidence is there that they exist? If they do exist, how can we come to know them? Plato answers all these questions beginning from the common experience of everyday life. People gain their first impression of justice or injustice from ordinary experience. This experience includes the ways they're treated by other people or the ways in which they see other people act towards one another. But our judgments of these individual experiences don't occur as individually or separately as the events themselves. So, for example, when we praise people or specific actions as just or good, Plato claims we're judging them by a single, common standard of justice or goodness that we bring to bear. But we can do this only if such a standard exists independently of the instances themselves. That is, if we can reapply the standard when new occasions arise. Plato holds,
a form is always one and the same. Particular things that have the property of a form obtain it by participating in or mingling with the form.
This holds true for all the qualities of which there are forms. For example, beauty is a form that is always one and the same.
If someone tells me that the reason why a given object is beautiful is that it has a gorgeous color or shape or any other such quality, I disregard all these other explanations. I cling simply and straightforwardly to the explanation that the one thing that makes the object beautiful is the presence in it or in association with it of absolute beauty. Beauty in itself.
For Plato, similar reasons imply the existence of justice and the other forms that are necessary for ethical judgment. For example, courage, piety, or temperance. The forms are never seen physically. They can only be known or thought. And yet, in Plato's conception, they are more real than objects that are seen or sensed. The values they name are, for him, objective and real. To be sure, logical consistency requires that similar forms should be admitted to exist for other qualities or objects as well. Plato says that forms do exist for everything, including those things which, like colors, may seem less important than ethical qualities. Thus, there is, in effect, a full world of forms, a world on which the other world of common experience is based. Plato holds that the world of forms is permanent and real. The world of common experience is constantly changing and occasional, and to this extent, common experiences are unreal. Any particular form, then, is more fundamental than the many particular sensible objects of which it is the form. The form could and often does exist without them, but not the other way around. One of Plato's most instructive descriptions of a form appears in the Republic in his account of the form of bedness. The existence of this unlikely principle, the form of the real bed, follows from the same line of reasoning that leads Plato to speak of forms elsewhere. The carpenter, he reminds us, makes a bed based on his conception of what a bed is. This conception, however, is more than only an idea in the carpenter's mind. It also reflects a structure or pattern that extends beyond him or any other carpenter.
The craftsman who produces a bed does so by fixing his eyes on the idea, or form. And surely no craftsman makes the idea or form itself.
Indeed, all the beds, past, present, or future, share certain objective properties, that is, properties which exist apart from any particular person's conception of them. Otherwise, there would be no common recognition of beds as beds. Bedness, then, is the form that enables, even causes, individual beds to be beds. To be sure, there are many different kinds and shapes of beds, but nonetheless, there's only one form or common principle that they all share. Plato explains this in the same way that he explains why there are forms at all.
If there were two forms of bedness, there would have to be another one of which the two would then possess the form or idea. And that would be the bed that really is, in and of itself, and not the other two.
Whether or not particular beds are different from each other in shape or material, they still retain the common features that make them beds. The craftsman who builds them imitates the form of bedness in order to make a bed that can be slept in. Yet the form itself can't be slept in, any more than can any other principle or definition. In this sense, the bed to be slept in is less real than the form of the bed. Why? Because the bed to be slept in could not exist without the form, but the form can exist without a physical example of it. By the same token, an artist who makes a painting of a bed produces an imitation of an imitation, a bed that can be seen but is not even slept in. This is another reason for Plato's repeated attacks on art and the artists. In their work, the painters and poets move further and further away from the world of forms. They are more removed from it than the world of sense experience.
The arts of imitation are far removed from truth. For it is phantoms, not realities, that they produce, only their semblance or appearance. If the artist were able to make the real thing, it is unlikely that he would devote himself to the imitation of them.
In the same way that particular beds are evidence for the form of bedness, instances of courage suggest a general form of courage. Instances of temperance and piety demonstrate that these forms exist. In instances of justice, tell us that there is a general form of justice. The theory of forms, then, is at the center of Plato's thinking about the ideal state and the nature of justice. The forms also are central to Plato's concept of reality more generally. So Plato holds that in order to be just, the state and its rulers must have access to the form of the good on which justice itself is based.
The form of the good is the cause of knowledge and truth, the highest of the forms, which, acting like the sun, illuminates all the others.
As we've seen, the Republic begins by questioning what role justice has in the life of the individual. It asks, for example, whether the just man is happier than the unjust man. To answer this, Plato turns to the question of what justice is in the state, since justice appears in the state on a larger scale than it does in the individual. But all these steps presuppose that there is such a thing as justice, and that human understanding can grasp it. In this way, the dialogue shows that thinking about the ideal state depends not only on evidence about laws and government, it also involves quite general questions about the nature of knowledge and reality. Plato repeatedly asserts that justice involves or presupposes knowledge. For justice to exist, knowledge must exist. This also explains why the rulers of the ideal republic have to know not only the form of justice, but all the other forms to which the form of justice is related. In a significant allegory on the Republic, Plato describes a cave in which a number of men are held prisoner. The men are tied up in such a way that they can only look straight ahead. All they can see, then, are shadows projected on the wall of the cave. Since the prisoners never see anything but these shadows, it's natural for them to think that the shadows on the wall are real. Nothing else exists for them. But suddenly, then, one of the prisoners is freed and makes his way out of the cave, emerging into the sunlight. The change is difficult for the freed man, and at first he refuses to look at the new world around him.
If he were compelled to look at the light itself, would not that pain his eyes? And would he not turn away and flee to those things which he is able to discern in the shadows, and regard them as more clear and more exact than the objects illuminated by the sun?
Gradually, however, the freed prisoner recognizes that the images he'd seen in the cave wall were indeed only shadows of the world that he now sees around him so clearly. Reluctantly, he returns to the cave and tells the other prisoners about his discovery. But they refuse to believe him. They know only the world of shadows. They have no reason to doubt that this world is real. In fact, they resent the returning prisoner and the news he brings about another reality. He wants them to give up their traditional beliefs. They might even kill him, Plato suggests, reminding us of what the Athenians did to Socrates when he suggested that they did not have the knowledge they thought they did. In this allegory, Plato says, the role of the escaped prisoner is the role of the philosopher.
This image we must apply as a whole to all that has been said, comparing the region revealed by sight with the habitation of the prison. And if you assume that the ascent from the cave and the contemplation of the things outside it is the mind's ascent to the realm of reason, you will not miss my own interpretation.
The philosopher's task is to demonstrate to others that there is a difference between the world of shadows and the real world. To reveal that difference is the constant challenge to reason and to the philosopher, as he attempts to teach others. This challenge applies to our thinking about politics and the state. Indeed, it applies to all thinking.
This is the end of Side One. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.